This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. We're without a sponsor this evening, but if you would like to sponsor the show, you can get in touch with us through our website at outofschool.net. Evening, Bradley. How are you?
I am absolutely fantastic. I'm finally recovered from the conference I was at earlier in the week, and kind of caught up from work, and you know, one of the things it just shows the differences in our education systems. I am, you know, very quickly moving towards the new year, and I know you guys are just finishing up the current year. So I've already enrolled.
Yeah, we are.
I actually fell asleep last night enrolling students in their new classes. I got the class list from our headmaster, and I was working on that. We were trying to. It's kind of a systematic process for us. Like, the headmaster basically builds it in Excel. He sends it to me, then I actually go through it and kind of do that in our student information system, and then we send basically like a PDF to the teachers with the students' names, addresses, and their parents' names. Because what we do is, it's really a big deal at our school, like who your teacher is. I don't know if it's your school, like, you know, it's just a big deal. It's very secretive. So next Friday, letters go out from the teachers to basically, like, so theoretically Saturday or Monday, you would get a letter from your teacher, and it's, you know, so then you know. So, like, especially among our parents on Facebook, like, they're talking, and it's who got who, you know, who's in our class, and it's just a big deal.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's never really something that's very secretive in our school. I don't know. I don't even know about other schools in Scotland, but certainly at Cedars, it's never been a thing that, I guess we sort of decide that far enough in advance, and there's, because we're so small, there's not really that many teachers to choose from, so it's going to be one of probably two or three at the most, so... Yeah, I spent the whole of today actually just kind of finishing up our old iPads. We gathered them all in. We're talking on a Thursday, and last Friday, the Friday before this, we had everybody start to leave their iPads in school. So all the people who would normally take them home, we collected in as many as were present on that Friday, and then we got some more on the Monday, and a couple more chargers and cables coming in on Tuesday. And by today, we pretty much had all of them. So my job for today was basically to sit at my desk with as many USB hubs as I could find a socket for, and wipe all these iPads through Apple Configurator, which it turns out I kind of screwed up the process on this, because we had all these devices enrolled in Meraki, and then because I was kind of ignoring Meraki in anticipation of moving towards Casper, I let the Apple push notification certificate expire in the Meraki system, which meant that I couldn't push a remove passcode command to all these devices, so they were all passcode locked, and a lot of the labels had fallen off them, so either I could sort of try everybody's passcode and see, but what I did in the end was I just forced them into recovery mode and connected them that way.
Yeah, that would have been a much easier process had you been able to use the web interface and just said blow it, you know. Yeah, that would have been easier.
Yeah, so I've learned a lesson for 3 years from now, so hopefully I'll make a note that will last this long.
So how many did you send to Rwanda?
Yeah, so the team's actually just back from Rwanda. They came back on Tuesday. We sent 30 with them, and they went to the charity that we worked with, Aid for Education. They have a center there in Rwanda, and then there are two schools, and we took 10 to each school. Some to the center itself, and then some went to a street kids charity that works there. It's kind of partnership with the charity that we worked with. And then one or two went to a women's farming cooperative in the area as well. So we kind of spread them around. We sent out 3 Wi-Fi base stations, and I was supposed to go on the trip and be the guy who set up the Wi-Fi. But in fact, my friend Gordon, who went on the trip, he did an excellent job in kind of dealing with what he found on the ground and getting it all done. So it was funny because a few people were kind of a bit skeptical about our capacity to deploy Wi-Fi in Africa. And, you know, they were like, oh, well, you'll probably not get that done, you know. And in fact, within the first hour of being in the center, one of them was up and running with Wi-Fi, and we were having a FaceTime call back to Scotland. So it worked. So we sent 30 in total there. So we had 115 in our kit. And of that, I spent the day kind of separating them into a pile that were basically in fine condition, a pile that were cosmetically not so great, and there were only actually 2 that were actually damaged in some way. One had a crack in the corner of the screen, and one had a dent that was kind of fouling the sleep-wake button. So there were two that we felt were not recyclable or saleable, and the rest were reasonably decent.
What will you do with the ones you have left?
So our reseller, who we're working with for our new lease, they have a recycling buyback scheme where they'll take our devices and give us a certain amount of money for each of them, depending on their condition. So I think for a complete set, a box set of iPad, cable, and charger that's in perfect condition or you know, used but you know, not broken or dented or damaged condition, they're going to offer us about £75 per device, which is, I think, is great for a device that has been so well used and is so far behind the curve right now. And then obviously there's a kind of sliding scale of less money for ones that maybe are missing their charger or they've got dents on the back of the screen or something like that. So that's the way we're doing that this year. We're moving on to a new leasing model next year where we won't actually have ownership of the devices at the end. So we'll end up just giving them back to the finance company and they'll do that and get the money back basically instead of us doing it. But the payback for that for us is that we pay less per month or per quarter during the lease.
And we just make actually a lump sum payment on our lease in August. Just because we're so cash heavy, it's kind of like, let's just get that big payment done and be done with it. Because we're really cash heavy right now in the summer because we're still we've not started the new fiscal year, but we're already collecting money for it because our parents start the tuition for the next school year actually in June, even though school doesn't start until mid-August. So I've got about a $30,000 payment coming due shortly.
Okay. Yeah, it's always scary to see that grow.
Yeah, no doubt. Thankfully, it's budgeted for and should be good.
So that was pretty much we're wrapping up the year. I thought it was interesting just to kind of look at the condition of some of these iPads, and a number of them were kind of dented on the back, but and almost all some of them had scratches on the screen, but not that many. And I was really impressed with, you know, how well these things have survived. And I think it's kind of testament to the quality of that device that it has taken that kind of punishment and it's survived almost intact. I mean, we've talked before about our breakage rate, and we seem to have achieved a rate that's much, much lower than the kind of education average. I think that's partly because we have carpet everywhere in our school, which certainly helps a lot if you ever drop it. But iPad, you know, for a 1.0 product, for a first generation product, I think the iPad 1 has been an amazing device. I would do it all again if I could.
I have the cases, I guess. Those are probably pretty much done, I would say.
Yeah, they're pretty horrible. There are, you know, I had some kids, I had the big crate full of them, and I had some kids split them into ones that were frayed and split and burst, and ones that were okay, albeit cosmetically not very nice. And they came back with remarkably few that were burst. I mean, I had replaced a few over the course of the 3 years, but in general, you know, when people saw the first Apple case, they thought, well, you know, that's not even going to last a fortnight with those kind of heat-sealed seams and everything like that. And in fact, that we've got so many that are still together after 3 years is kind of amazing to me. So, tell me about your travels, Bradley.
Yeah, I guess it was last December, I got a email from a friend of mine at Arrowhive Networks, which no stranger to this show, even last week's guest was from Arrowhive Networks, and they said, hey, we've been selected to have a panel at this conference. It's the short name is ISTE, and it's the International Society of Technology and Education, and their annual conference was in San Antonio, Texas this year. Says, hey, would you like to come and be on a panel about mobile devices and the networks behind them, and basically designing Wi-Fi for iPads, iPhones, and the whatnot? So I said, sure. So conference was this week, and it's actually still going on. I guess it actually is ending this afternoon. I was only there just a couple days with my wife being 8 months pregnant, us just moving into a new house and quickly preparing for the next school year. I thought, well, let's get on back home. So I flew out on Sunday morning and got to San Antonio mid-afternoon. On Monday, spent some time basically walking the show floor. I didn't attend any sessions, but because mainly my schedule with Arrowhive didn't really allow it, I was working, doing a presentation actually in their booth at one point in the morning, and then our panel was in the afternoon. So I really just spent some time walking around and observing basically kind of the layout of the exhibitor booths, because mm-hmm. I feel like you can tell a lot from that, like what are they talking about, what are they pushing. And really it was interesting. What, you know, 13,000 people are in attendance, so it's really one of the, I think it's the largest in the U.S. And maybe one of the largest in the world. I'd never been to a conference that big. A lot of people. San Antonio is a beautiful city, but it's very hot this time of year. Mm. Had a great steak both nights, in case anybody cares.
What else does one do in Texas?
True. So Apple was one of the kind of featured sponsors, but did not have a booth that I could see.
That's interesting.
And I walked. But of course, it's funny because everybody else did all of the advertising for Apple.
Yeah.
A lot of booths, especially the bigger booths, like they would do giveaways. Of course, I have learned better in recent years as I've gotten a little older that it is not worth dropping your business card in every booth just for the chance to win an iPad, because the amount of spam you will then receive more than takes over the benefit of getting the iPad. And I know that's just the way this businesses work. You know, they got to get the customers on their list. And even when I got back in my mailbox here at work, I had literally like 10 postcards from come see us at come see our booth at ISTE. I didn't work the Friday before because I didn't feel well. So it was just kind of one of those things.
So when you were walking the show floor, then what did you kind of take away as the big, I guess. One of the ways that you can measure this at a trade show like that is square yardage on the floor. Like what's getting the biggest space and the highest banners?
You know, Google had a very, very big booth, but not really talking Google Apps in terms of like the booth actual setup. Mm-hmm. They were talking a lot about, they showed a lot of Chromebooks. They showed a lot of their tablets. And then a lot of booths were doing presentations actually in their booth. Of course, it's very difficult because of how loud it is, but Google was talking a lot about some of the features that built into Google Drive now, which we've talked about, I believe, offline. It's really gotten great. Viable office replacement for, I think, most schools. I mean, if you're an accountant, I don't think that Google Spreadsheets is your best bet. But for like what our teachers are doing in Excel, Google Spreadsheets works fine.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I mean, I think the iOS app needs to mature a little bit more in terms of editing. I mean, I looked at, because obviously I teach some spreadsheet work as part of my courses. I've had a look at it in terms of, could I use that instead of numbers? And the answer I would say is sort of not yet, but close. And in some ways, it's more of a kind of pure spreadsheet than numbers is, because numbers has obviously got some sort of layout features and things as well. Whereas the Google Docs spreadsheet is pretty much... there's not real support for building formulas. It's just like you type in the formula and see if it works kind of thing.
Thinking about really the kind of the overall atmosphere of the show, it was really a lot about the tablet. And when I say tablet, I really mean iPad, because although Dell had a huge booth, Microsoft had a big presence that we'll talk about in a second. Toshiba was there. And so they're all talking about their tablets. But what I felt was interesting is all the other booths were talking about things, either they're giving away an iPad or they're talking about how their products work with the iPad. And so, going back to Apple not having a booth, they didn't have to. Everybody else was advertising for them. People there, Bretford was there talking about, they had their carts on display that they sell, mm-hmm. their charging solution. So Apple didn't have to, the whole industry, largely our industry right now is focused on the iPad and discussion around that. So, Apple can make their token donation and say, look, we're going to let our partners and vendors basically advertise for us.
Yeah, and I mean, there's no doubt that there are certainly people from Apple there, just not on a stand.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. I absolutely. Now, one of the things that was interesting is Microsoft gave away 10,000 Surface RTs. So there's 13,000 attendees by the numbers I saw. So they gave away 10,000. And so,
how did you get into the lucky 3,000 that you didn't have to take a Surface RT?
Well, I think that like the invite went out to everybody, but they basically gave them out until they ran out.
Okay.
So, and I would love to kind of compare the, if you could, I'm sure it's out there somewhere, like the cost of goods sold of the Surface RT. So let's say on example. I don't know. You think it retails at $4.99. So what do you think their cost is on that? Do you think that's like $250, $350 maybe? You think $350 is like a good estimate?
Yeah, hard to be absolutely sure. But, I mean, the Surface products are built from some pretty interesting materials. They're not just a plastic box with some wires and brains in them. They're those magnesium, whatever they call them, magnesium vapor shell or something like that. They're fairly intricate in themselves.
So let's just do 350 times 10,000. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4 zeros. By my math in Solver, that's $3.5 million that they gave away just in hardware.
Yeah.
And so the question I guess I have, and I kind of pondered as I talked to people, was this a smart move by Microsoft or was this a desperate move?
It's probably the biggest Surface RT deployment in education anywhere.
Oh, absolutely. absolutely. But you think about it. Are they trying to go in? Because this is a conference really attended by teachers. It's not really meant, you know, people like me and you. It's people that are straight-up teachers all day long.
Yeah.
And if they can get the teachers excited about the Surface. Now, we're not talking about is it a good or bad device, better or worse than the iPad. I'm saying from a marketing strategy, I think it was kind of genius. Because there are, you know, if they went out and bought a television ad or magazine ads in the education magazines, they could easily spend that much money on advertising and really have no bang for their buck. But they can be guaranteed that there are, you know, Surfaces in the hand of teachers now. And what if they love those? And they, let's say you have a teacher that's really into Microsoft Office for whatever reason, then they may start, you know, pestering their headmaster, pestering their IT people. Hey, let's deploy Surfaces to our students. I don't know.
Yeah, I think one of the things about giving it to people who go to something like ISTE is that those are the technical opinion formers in their schools, probably. So they're the kind of people that if Microsoft or any company can reach those people, those people can then influence other people in the school. So they go back to the school and they go, look what I got for you at ISTE. It's a Surface tablet or whatever. And it gets handed around the staff room and people show off and blah, blah, blah. I think that's certainly a way in, because I think the problem Microsoft has got is to get people to even consider. You know, it's not a matter of adopting or scaling a project. Microsoft's problem with Surface RT is essentially people aren't even really considering it as a product. I think that's partly because, well, there's two problems. One I think is that nobody understands the difference between RT and Windows 8, and nobody understands the hardware difference between the RT tablet and the Pro tablet. People are just radically confused about that. And secondly, I think the move to Windows 8 is people are unsure about the signal Microsoft's giving with that as well, because, you know, just in the news today or yesterday, Windows 8.1, which is now bringing back things like the start button and the ability to boot back to the desktop. So Microsoft themselves are sending kind of an uncertain note as to where they're going with this whole thing. And I think the chances of people spending $500 just to try one out is pretty small. So giving them away is one way to get it into people's hands and get it even considered.
Well, and, you know, this is the same problem that the Mac had many years ago. I think
Absolutely.
There was, you know, it wasn't that they were not, you know, picking the Mac. It just wasn't even in the discussion. And so there's a bigger problem here for Microsoft in terms of schools, because it's not like if they're just going after the iPad consumer market, well, somebody may conceivably buy an iPad every year. If you have an iPad 2, you know, you bought it maybe a year ago, you think, oh, this Surface looks nice, let's try that out. They have that shot roughly maybe once a year. With these school deployments, they only kind of come around every 3 to 4 years, you know. And so if you miss a big deployment, you know, like Microsoft just missed the big contract out in Los Angeles that Apple won. Of course, Apple missed the one out in Maine that I think HP won. Mm-hmm. You don't get those shots every spring. You get them. Yeah. You know, they just kind of come around every few years. And so they've got to get in that discussion. And I think it really was a smart move by Microsoft. Again, it's a lot of money. But in the grand scheme of things for Microsoft Education, like, that's not that much money.
No, it's not. And they're also – I noticed a thing on the web the other day where they were basically giving away – Surface RTs at what I guess is even possibly below cost price. I think they were letting them go for $200 or something like that for the basic model. It certainly seems like either Surface RT is either going away or about to get a massive upgrade, because They seem to be doing quite a lot to get rid of whatever ones they've got. And it'll be interesting to see which one of those two it is. Because I don't know if you got your hands on one, Bradley, but I've tried a Surface RT before as well, and I found it to be unbelievably slow. I was quite shocked, honestly, at how slow performing Microsoft Office was on that device. And I think, given that Microsoft Office on a tablet is like the number one selling point of a Surface tablet or a Windows 8 tablet, then to have it be so slow in Microsoft's own hardware was quite surprising.
You know, I find it funny, like kind of like, I guess the theoretical differences between what we love about iOS and then maybe what other people are loving about not only the Surface, but also these kind of hybrid tablet laptop devices. And I sat next to a guy on a plane who was speaking. He was from a school out in Ohio, and he actually, you know, I love to be able to pitch the podcast in these situations because I feel like it's, you know, people that actually might care. And he said, "Oh, I've actually talked to Fraser before. We've kind of debated about the iPad versus the they use like a Fujitsu tablet." And very nice guy. And we, you know, I enjoyed watching him use his device. And then I think he watched me use my iPad a little bit. It was, you gotta love in-flight Wi-Fi. I feel like that's like one of the most of all the modern inventions, that I can use the internet in the air. Was just a beautiful thing. But I, you know, and his selling point to me was, I can do all, run all my Adobe apps. I can run Office. It's my desktop experience. And I find that ironic because that's the reason I love iOS, is it's not my desktop experience. It's getting rid of all the cruft and all the things of that, and I can just, you know, the iPad in some ways is almost like a window. It's a window, you know, if I'm in OmniFocus, it's an OmniFocus tablet. If I'm in Evernote, it's an Evernote machine. And I largely like the iPad for the reasons, you know, the opposite reasons of why he likes his tablet. And so I wonder, is there a market for both? Or is that just a kind of fundamental difference between people that are kind of in a Microsoft shop versus a, you know, Apple school?
It's interesting you should say that. I mean, there's a quote from me on a slide that Apple people use when they're doing their pitch for iPad in education, and it's actually kind of a misquote. And what it says on the slide, if you've ever been to an Apple event, you might see a slide that says, the iPad is not technology, it's content, quote Fraser Spears. And what I actually said was, the iPad becomes the thing you're doing with it. And it's actually a broader assertion than just its content, but it becomes a piece of paper, it becomes a mixing desk, it becomes a video editing deck or whatever. And I think it's more than just, you know, one window per app that's full screen. But it's that because the hardware is so kind of minimalist that it just, it kind of goes away. And, you know, the iPad can become a book, or it can become this, or it can become that, or it can become a game. And I really think that kind of almost illusion is really, really important. Because whereas, I just don't feel like your Surface ever becomes, you know, the thing you're doing with it. And I think partly it's because the shape of the Surface is a bit, the aspect ratio is a bit weird for some of that stuff. But also, if it is your desktop program, you've got your desktop in multiple windows and stuff that you're doing with, if you're in desktop mode in these things, I just feel like it's just like a very awkward to handle laptop, you know? I mean, in some ways, I think my biggest critique of the Microsoft Surface is that it's not even a tablet, it's actually a desktop computer pretending to be a tablet. Because if you think about the way it's supposed to be used, with the kickstand and the keyboard case and all of these things, you almost have to have a desktop in order to lay it out properly and comfortably so you can use it in a stable fashion. And of course, the iPad has its own issues with that, in the sense that you really need a case to kind of prop it up into all the angles you want to use it in. And that's another discussion for another show. We can talk about iPad cases till the cows come home. But it's two different emphases, and I think there'll be some people for whom they want everything in one device. But I think what's really interesting about it, and where the kind of end game for this is that that will be possible in iOS. You know, you won't have to run you won't be waiting for OS X to come to iPad in order to have it all on the go. What will just happen is that iOS will grow and become, and it already is for some people. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, and the hardware will get more powerful. The apps will, you know, come around. The, you know, I guess the pro apps that people are wanting.
And 128 gig iPad.
Yeah. And I actually traveled. I did not bring my Mac with me this weekend. I just traveled with my iPad, my iPhone, and I did take a Bluetooth keyboard, and it was fun. I never once needed my Mac. There was, you know, just everything really, really worked.
Let me tell you one other thing about that. The team that went to Rwanda, nobody took a laptop. It's iPhones, iPads.
It's a breeze when traveling. When I went to Africa a few years ago, I literally just took my iPhone. It's just because I didn't want to deal with the... I mean, again, this is a hashtag first world problem, but it's just big. And I just didn't want to deal with it. I took my Mini. I had a Mini and a Bluetooth keyboard in my phone. And should have taken two chargers. I just took one. But, one of the things it was funny. When I was watching him, he actually had to reboot the machine and kill apps in the task manager. But that's a low blow.
The full desktop experience.
But do you think that – so we're talking about Office and it being slow. Now, and largely we all talk about how, Pages is like, for a mobile word processor, Pages is pretty good. Do you think that a lot of Surface's problems and the reason that it is what it is that Microsoft is not very good at writing mobile apps?
Interesting question. I mean, I think a lot of people who program iOS, I mean, one of the things that Apple has been criticized for over some time now is for not having quote-unquote modern memory managed languages with garbage collection and all of these kind of additional programmer support things in the runtime, but in fact that has actually worked to Apple's advantage because the overhead of a lot of that stuff is quite high, and when you get into mobile devices you don't necessarily want to pay the overhead of having a garbage collector run or memory manager or whatever. And in some ways, if you're building on top of what are essentially desktop technologies, you can sometimes struggle with that. And I think Apple's slightly closer to the metal approach to some of the stuff that they've done has paid off in spades in iOS, at least in the early days when devices were not that powerful. And I think that what's quite interesting to me is that so quickly, within 6 years, we've gone from, having to really optimize stuff for very, very weak mobile processors to the point now where you've got very, the A6X processor is incredibly powerful, it's powering a Retina display and so on. How quickly those problems will go away, I'm not absolutely sure, but, Moore's Law is pretty relentless.
It's interesting. Of course, I blogged about it a few weeks ago that, Office for iPhone is out. And did we talk about this on the show? Have we talked since then?
We might have. I might have fallen asleep.
My point was it's really dead on arrival. Of course, it's not on the iPad. It's iPhone only, but it requires a 365 subscription. And, of course, obviously, I guess Microsoft in some ways considers that their future of their platforms. And that's fine. But you've got to think, who is somebody that is really, really going to be really excited about Office for iOS or iPhone? It's not, I guess, people like me and you that, we're using Google Drive and iWork and things like that. It's going to be the big Microsoft environments that are probably already, they've got their, Exchange on site, they've got their shared drives and domain controller. And so they have no way to, and there's no way to keep, there's no way to keep those two in sync. And so they have to then, buy a second subscription. And it's like Microsoft, it's almost like they look, and we've criticized them for not doing that in the past, but a large portion of their business customers can't use Office on the iPhone because they don't have 365. They're using their traditional enterprise tools. And my thing is they should have sold it for $40, $25, $30, and built some sort of, have 365 syncing and SkyDrive syncing, but also have a way for IT departments to install something in a Microsoft environment that handles the syncing from their shared drives. Have kind of the best of both worlds. And I think they could have sold a lot of copies of Microsoft Office for the iPhone and certainly the iPad when it's released. But also, here's another kicker. Because it is only – you can do an in-app purchase for SkyDrive or for the 365 subscription. There's no way to do volume purchasing of a in-app purchase. So there's no way for a school to buy that in mass unless there is 365 school.
Yeah, it has to almost be like the other end of the strategy. You've got to have the 365 in place first and then come to it from the iPhone. I mean, I think there's a massive kind of strategy tax being paid there by not bringing that out on the iPad first. I mean, that's one of the things mean, it's in Microsoft's adverts, right, is that, you know, the Windows 8 tablet is the one that can run PowerPoint, and we'll make fun of the iPad for not being able to run PowerPoint, although many of us may consider that to be a feature rather than a bug. But, you know, like, who's excited for documents on their phone? You know, I mean, it's great to have it there, and I've seen, you know, in a pinch I have myself done a keynote presentation from my iPhone, but it's not, you know, it's like the cherry on the top of a whole other thing. It's not, you know, it's not a fundamental part of your productivity workflow, I don't think. I understand that, you know, the cost of transitioning to something else is very high, but I think the fundamental problem Microsoft has with a lot of these innovations is that anybody who was adventurous and looking for something new in their computing experience already left Microsoft platforms and products a long time ago, either for iOS or for Android or for whatever, Chromebook or something else. And I think you're sort of seeing that coming out with Windows 8.1 is that, you know, somebody commented on Twitter, I think it was Neil Patel from the Verge, said that the biggest cheer in the room at Microsoft's Build conference was for boot to the desktop and bring back the start button. And I think that kind of speaks to, you know, Microsoft's core audience now is people who sort of liked it the way it was. And all the adventurous and exciting people who have been looking for something new out of computing for several years now have all had probably about a decade's worth of opportunity to leave for something else now, whether that be OS X or iOS when it came along, or Android, or whatever, Chromebook. And I think that that's going to be the biggest hurdle for Microsoft to get over, is really how do you bring along these millions of people who are spending a lot of money to make sure nothing ever changes, which is what they really, really want. And they're almost paying Microsoft not to change it rather than to change it.
Yeah, you're right. Great conference overall. Again, you know, there's a lot of Wi-Fi companies there, Aruba, Ruckus, you know, Cisco, Meraki had a big booth there. You get lots of focus on MDM vendors. I did not see Casper there.
Okay.
But I know AirWatch was there and some other ones. And then a company called Gaggle, which I didn't have time to check out their booth, but they kind of basically, they go in, they work with Google Apps, and you can like do things like build class lists within Google Apps, so like if you're, you know, Google Apps users and things like that. Okay. So lots of neat innovation there. Trying to think some of the other vendors. Again, a lot of it revolved around the iPad and software for the iPad and, you know, things like that. And so again, Apple gets to, you know, have people there talking about their products without actually having to, you know, have a big booth.
Indeed. So how did your panel go?
It went well. It was about an hour and 15 minutes, and we were talking about basically, you know, the challenges that schools face, like with, you know, some of it was with BYOD situations, how to select a network, you know, why, you know, having a modern wireless network is important. And then we kind of talked about what's coming with AC. And one of the things that I kind of thought of it on Friday night, because I don't know if you've heard about these wireless bake-offs that a lot of schools do, where they bring somebody in, like they'll say, okay, we're going to have a bake-off day on this day, and they invite, you know, all the vendors to come in. They set up a test. They say, all right, we're going to have this file on this laptop on this access point, and we're going to move it across to that laptop on another access point. And basically, whoever is the fastest wins. And so the problem with that is, it's like if you go and you're buying a car that you'll look at the tires. And that's not what you're looking at when you buy a car. You're looking at the whole experience, because things matter more than just speed of a car. Like, you don't go when you're test driving cars and see which one can go the fastest. Do you want it to be able to go fast? Absolutely. Just as you want your Wi-Fi network to be able to, you know, go fast. But largely, you know, if one vendor has, you know, a 0.5% speed difference than another vendor, that's not going to make a difference day to day. You know, what's more important to me is like connectivity. You know, how are their features? How's their deployment model? How's their upgrade model if I need more APs? So there's more things to a wireless network than just pure speed. Although, again, speed is, you know, a factor, but it's just a small factor. So I really encouraged everybody in the panel. I think there was about 100 people, or encouraged everybody in the audience, because there was about 100 people there, that, you know, compare the details. Like, the devil in wireless deployment's really in the details. One of the things, again, we've talked about Aerohive that I love, is there's no feature licensing. When they have a new feature, it's just you get it as a free upgrade. You're already paying for it. You have, you know, You're paying a support contract, so any features you get, they release, you just get automatically, which is really the direct opposite of, say, SonicWall, which is owned by Dell. I just renewed my support contract, but they still have 1,000 features that I have to pay for every year if I want them. So what Arrowhive's doing is they're not making me decide which features are important to me. They just say, you get them all. And so with SonicWall, you know, their application control is $500 a year. I would have to make that decision every year. Is that important enough to me to continue paying $500 every year?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know whenever I evaluate a car, the two things I really care about are where can I mount my phone in the dashboard, and does the cup holder hold a Starbucks cup upright when I go round the roundabout? Everything else is gravy on top of that, I think. Yeah.
Well, because again, they're all good. Like all wireless vendors, you know, they're all okay. They're all, you know, what makes them different are the details. And so that's why I said the devil is in the details. Like you need to compare more than just speed.
Yeah, and I think the same thing is true of MDM. You know, I've been thinking a lot about this recently, obviously, and we've talked about it in previous shows, but, you know, everybody can get an SSID up and running, and people can connect. I mean, nobody is selling enterprise wireless where the connection is flaky, right? But it's, you know, the same thing with MDM. Everybody supports sending a configuration profile to a device, but it's things like, well, how do I bring people on board? Is there a captive portal? What's the process that I go through to provision new users into the system? Or, you know, it's all those little bits, and you've really, really got to think about, both for Wi-Fi and for MDM, you've really got to think through, you know, what does my day-to-day look like operating this system? You know, and it's not just even the deployment, right? Because you can get help with the deployment in the first case. You can buy that kind of help, or you might be given that help depending on how much money you're spending. But on a day-to-day, if something goes wrong, or even before something goes wrong, can I be notified of it? What do I do? What does it look like? What's the recovery mechanism? All that kind of stuff. You know, when somebody new comes to the school, a new pupil comes, can I provision them into all of these systems at once, or do I have to do it all separately, or all those kind of questions? You know, it's not just about these basic features anymore. It's about almost, I hesitate to say lifestyle, because it's not really the lifestyle, but it's the kind of the user experience of these things.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's like if you... Again, to me, the car analogy is perfect. Like, you don't just look at the tires. You look at, again, things like the cup holders. Does it have an aux input for my iPhone, or, you know, things like that? You know, it's funny. The car I drive right now is an Acura, and it has a 6-disc CD changer. And I do not own a CD. I actually own one CD. A friend of mine, he doesn't listen to the show because he's a musician. Not that musicians can't listen to the show, but, you know, he's not involved in technology in any way in the educational environment. But he has a band and new CD out, and it's not digital yet. So I actually bought the CD from him, and that's like the only CD I own. So it's strange to, like, you know, if you look, I'm looking in the car dash, and it's like, you know, has the one button, because that's all I have.
But one button, yeah. Okay, so we have something else to talk about tonight. Great experience from Misty, but Apple, in kind of follow-up, not that Apple followed up our podcast, because they clearly have bigger things to worry about than our podcast, but we talked 2 weeks ago about some of the stuff that came out from WWDC, and Apple has thrown up another couple of pages about information relating to iOS 7, there's one for education and there's one for business. And what the information that's on these pages, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes, but the information on these pages goes beyond some of the stuff that we were able to talk about last week, because there's more detail in these than we knew at the time. And also some of the things that were at the time under non-disclosure are now public on this page, so we can talk a little bit more about some of them. And some of the details are really, really important. So I thought, Bradley, it might be worth just going through that page and talking about some of the things that we maybe missed out or skipped over last time we spoke about iOS 7.
Yeah, perfect. And we will include a link to that page in the show notes at outofschool.net or in your favorite podcasting device.
Absolutely. So I want to make a meta point before we kind of get into the details here, but I just invite everybody to go to this page. And then in your browser, just search the page for the number of instances of the phrase MDM, or the acronym MDM. And if you count it, and I have counted it, the answer is 11 times Apple talks about your MDM system, blah, 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 blah. And I would like to suggest that that is probably a sign to you that this is becoming an important technology in one-to-one situations, because some of the things that we're going to talk about are basically controlled through your MDM system. So if you're planning one-to-one in the next couple of years, you're going to want to seriously think about what you're doing about MDM. So with that kind of proviso out of the way, let's dig in. And the first thing, and this is the thing we didn't really talk about very much a couple of weeks ago, is a section called App Store License Management. And if I just read what it says the App Store Volume Purchase Program now offers institutions the ability to assign apps to users while keeping full ownership and control over app licenses. Institutions purchase app licenses through the VPP website and can use their MDM solution to assign apps to students, faculty, and staff over the air. Students can enroll with their personal Apple ID without providing it to the institution, and apps are placed in their purchase history for self-service download or are installed automatically via MDM. Let me pause there, because there's a lot to unpack there. There's another paragraph which we'll talk about in a minute, which kind of talks about the life cycle of this whole process. But Bradley, it sounds like this is what we've kind of been waiting for a long time.
Yeah, it's one of those paragraphs you really want to read about five times.
Yeah, yeah. It's so what they're saying is basically, up till this page came out, WWDC, the model for bulk buying iOS applications has basically been to bulk buy gift codes. Basically, they're essentially exactly the same thing as if I went into the App Store and gifted to you an app. The problem we all had then was, well, how do we get these? How do we turn these codes into apps installed on devices? And there were really two ways to do it. One, if you had a personal model deployment where your end users were using their own Apple ID, you could give them a code, they could redeem it and get download. The big downside to that is that when that code is redeemed, that license or the purchase is gone, and the institution can't get it back. So you're basically eating the cost of giving away these apps time by time by time. The other way to do it was to put those codes into Apple Configurator, where over a USB cable you could deploy an app to a device, and then over a USB cable you could uninstall an app from that device, and you would retain ownership of that license. The problem with that being that, well, it was all over a USB cable, and you had to get the devices back to base to install, update, and then remove applications. What App Store License Management appears to do is it takes that capability of Apple Configurator, where you can buy once, deploy, and recall, and it makes it into an over-the-air system where you never have to touch the iPad back to base again. And that's a really big deal. I think that's really important.
Well, I mean, think about, you're a 100-person school, roughly. We're about 300. Imagine if you had a school that was 5,000, and this is even bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the key thing about this is that this is all about scaling one-to-one deployments to massive numbers. Because if you look further along in this paragraph, it says students enroll with their personal Apple ID, right? So instead of having a layered model where you have a school's Apple ID for some apps and a pupil's Apple ID for others, everything is through the pupil's Apple ID. It says apps are placed in their purchase history for self-service download or are installed automatically via MDM. So it suggests to me that what's going to happen when they say purchase history, that's going to be the purchase tab in the App Store. So it's just going to be like I've purchased Pages, Keynote, and Numbers. They magically appear in the App Store for me and I can install them, but I didn't have to pay for them. And the beauty of it is that that can also be revoked at any time and reassigned to another student over the air. And that's killer, right? Because that's the thing that only Apple Configurator could do, is to take that license back from somebody's iPad. Now you can do that basically as with an MDM command. So I just sit on my Casper dashboard and I go, assign this app to these people. It pops up in their app store. Then, maybe it's let's say it's a very expensive app and the project they're working on is done. I can revoke that application from them, give it to another class, and I don't have to touch those iPads at all. I don't have to see the iPads back. Whereas previously, that would have been a job for me to bring their iPads back, uninstall the app from them, get the other class's iPads in, install the app onto their iPads, and then, get on with our lives from there. So I think this part is going to be a really, really big deal. And this basically solves nearly all the problems that people have had with App Store license management, even post getting the volume purchase program, that constraint of bringing them into Configurator to install and reinstall is now gone as well. And it's all in the App Store, and you just control it through your MDM. I'm super excited about this.
If I can say one word about this paragraph, it's simplify. And this is what Apple's done. It's removed a lot of questions that you have to ask yourself, pre-deployment.
Yep.
And it really, long as you've got an MDM vendor that supports that, then you are in good shape.
Yeah, because for the last couple of years, I talk to schools a lot and I give presentations about this kind of stuff. And the one thing I've always said is, look, it's really important to get your model right at the start, because the cost of getting it wrong and then changing it are massive. And I think what this does is it sort of reduces that cost quite a lot. So that, if I deployed that app, and I shouldn't have deployed that app, I can bring it back or push it out to a different group or whatever, without having to kind of plan for costs down the line for new students and bringing other people onto the program and so on. You can just sort of do it all in the store. It's going to be really, really powerful. So that's part one. I'm not actually going to go through this in order, because I'm going to jump down to a later paragraph, and this is the other shoe dropping, if you like. It's entitled "Enroll Students of All Ages in iTunes U, iCloud, and More." The paragraph begins: students with Apple ID can have an enhanced personal experience with access to great online services like iTunes U, iCloud Backup, and the ability to receive licenses in the new volume purchase program. And now schools will have a program to facilitate Apple obtaining verifiable parental consent for personal Apple IDs for students under age 13. Boom. That is the problem that has sort of plagued a lot of schools. And I know, Bradley, all your users are under 13. So, and we've got this kind of split that we're working on just now, where our younger users will have one model and our older users will have another model. And that basically takes that problem away. So again, like you said, simplify. Everybody gets the same.
Yeah, we don't know exactly, all the details of this yet, but, or even, it'll launch with iOS 7, we hope. But I'm excited to hear that. If I know Apple, this is such a big change. I imagine that you will probably see some regional events discussing all the details of this. I know in the past, we've done those kind of road shows where they bring in their EDU folks and talk about it. And they may even bring in the folks from Casper as well. And if all this integrates together and really show you exactly how this stuff works. But this is big for lower schools, no doubt.
Yeah, it's not clear exactly what the process of Apple obtaining that parental consent is going to be, or whether or not those under 13 Apple IDs have any kind of different behaviors or anything. But, it certainly seems like iTunes U, iCloud Backup, all the big things that Apple IDs do for you are going to be available to everybody. My big question, and I don't know the answer to this, is let's say, for example, I don't actually want a 7-year-old to have access to the App Store. Is it possible for me to still have them create an Apple ID to use iCloud Backup and iTunes U, but then turn off the App Store on the device, yet still push apps to their device? So basically, it's like an institutional model, but using personal iCloud Backup and using their Apple ID for apps, mm-hmm. but I'm pushing all the content to their device and they can't put their own ones on. That's the question. Because one of the things with the way the App Store works is that if you say you put in place an app restriction for apps, 12 plus only, if you have 17, and there are 17 plus applications in the App Store, when you have that restriction on a device, you can still search for those apps, but you cannot buy them, and you cannot see their screenshots either. But I think, if we're going to put 5 and 6 and 7 year olds onto the App Store, I think it's a question of whether Apple should actually remove those apps from the search index as well for students who are that age and under. That's probably something still to be worked on. So those are the two big things, and everything else kind of is small by comparison to those, because those are things that I don't know about you, Bradley, but every time I've had somebody visit my school or I've been to some visit somebody else's school, I have had at least one conversation about these two topics already, apps and Apple IDs. And it's going to be nice to have a new story to tell, which will hopefully satisfy everybody.
It removes a lot of the gotchas and a lot of the, well, you'll just have to fumble through that scenario. You could even say, like, this is the definitive way that you deploy iOS in your school. Like, this is the way. There are no more variables. You do it this way, and this way works.
And I think the thing about this, though, Bradley, is that this, it seems to me from my reading of this page that this is really all about one-to-one deployments. And I think if you're still doing shared deployments, probably Apple Configurator is still going to be an important tool for you. Because obviously, you know, there's a lot of things. If you have students sign into an iPad with their own Apple ID and download content, those iPads are sort of locked into their accounts for a certain amount of time. I think it's 90 days. So if you're thinking about sharing iPads on a frequent basis, you probably will still want to be looking at Apple Configurator. But my sense is that if you are going one-to-one, these are now the tools that you use.
You know, AirDrop will be, that'll be nice day-to-day. That doesn't really affect your deployment model, but that'll be handy, like a teacher turning in something. I think we mentioned that on a few shows last week. That'll be a nice addition.
I think there's one area in which AirDrop actually does make a big difference, I think, and that is, it's now an open question as to whether you necessarily need to deploy email to students. Because one of the big reasons that I, you know, have in the past advocated that people do that is because email is the way that you transfer files to your teacher, basically. But if AirDrop is what we all think it's going to be, then perhaps that's yet another use case that is kind of gone for email. So we've knocked it down in our school. We've knocked it down because iTunes U has taken on a lot of the jobs that we did used email for. Shobi is another app we've talked about in the past, which is going to take on another use case, which is some like a graded work submission. And then AirDrop is going to take on yet another use case that we used email for, which was pupil to pupil and pupil to teacher sharing of files on an ad hoc basis. That can now all happen over AirDrop as well. So it's interesting. You know, I'm not ready to say nobody needs email anymore, but it's one less reason that you have to have email for every student. And I can easily see me starting to eliminate email for the very youngest students because they just don't need it.
Yeah, I agree. It's just one less headache. And if your only reason was getting content to and fro, then...
Except now they're going to need it for an Apple ID, of course.
That's true.
So maybe we'll keep it going for that.
The Apple TV enhancements were nice. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if we talked about this on a previous show, that one of the sentences that's great is iOS devices can be pre-configured with AirPlay destination settings using configuration profiles. So that'll be very nice to have that kind of set. You know, that way you can program a passcode in, but they don't have to know the passcode.
Yeah, I think it's essentially almost the exact same thing as Wi-Fi payloads and configuration, where there's a password for the Wi-Fi on the device, but the student doesn't know it because it was delivered over a configuration profile.
Oh, this is neat. I just actually caught this. And MDM can prompt a student to mirror their screen on a specific Apple TV so teachers can easily put their work in the big screen. So that I imagine that's something like in Casper, the teacher would say, all right, ask the student to mirror, and then they'd have that option. That could be neat.
Yeah, I that feels like, you know... that's a specific thing there that can be a new feature of Casper Focus, for example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
My question, though, and this is kind of an interesting thing, is what this basically means is that some third party can force your iPad to be mirrored onto a specific display. And that's fine. You know, there are lots of ways that you might want to use that. But the question is, can you have that but prevent the student themselves from mirroring to a display? So could you make it that you can only get to an Apple TV if that was initiated by a teacher and not by a student?
That would be the ideal way.
That seems, you know, I can see some cases and some scenarios where that might be a hammer you have to bring down. And I think perhaps in a large school, the truth of the matter is that it's not so much malicious attempts to take over an Apple TV as just accidental taking over an Apple TV by tapping the wrong one in a list of 30 or 40. that is actually the bigger problem of them all. So yeah, Apple TV. Also, Apple TV can be managed in MDM as well. Set up your Wi-Fi. Doesn't say very much else what it can do, but it says configuration settings like Wi-Fi and default language. Interesting to see if other things come along. One question I have on that is, am I going to have to pay a per-seat MDM license just to manage Apple TVs as well?
That would be my question. And is there like a reduced... I mean, you'd think there'd be some sort of reduced rate for that because it's not a... It doesn't get the same kind of interaction.
Yeah, it would be nice if your MDM vendor would just say, okay, you can manage Apple TVs for free. That would be nice.
I would like to
as
see...
As long as you have, you know, 10 times the number of client licenses or something.
Yeah, you could say, like, you don't want to have, like, one client license and 500 Apple TVs, but, you know, yeah. For every, I don't know, 10 students, you got one Apple TV included. I would like to see AirPlay almost have an AirDrop-type feature, where if you were like within so many feet of the Apple TV, it could almost just work without even using Wi-Fi. So that way, if your Wi-Fi was flaky or it was at capacity, it could still it could still function.
Yeah, I think that's probably the next generation of thing for Apple TV. I mean, I've been in situations. I mean, I would love it if I could make Apple TV a thing that I take with me to presentations, right? But you can't do that because you've got to, you know, get the Apple TV up on their network, get your device up on their network, trust that that's going to work. Whereas if there was some way to go direct from a device to an Apple TV without any other infrastructure, you could, instead of carrying along, you know, a VGA dongle or whatever, you could just carry along an Apple TV, stick that on their cable, use your iPad, you're done. And maybe that's the future of Apple TV. I don't know.
Yes, because we've talked about caching server 2 before, and single sign-on is probably something more used in you know, big Microsoft environments where they've got like a Active Directory and it's, you know, multiple applications are accessing that somehow. Is that what you can gather from it?
Yeah, it sounds like Kerberos to me. You know, that kind of thing. Tickets and various things. I had kind of hoped that it might be something that you could say, like the Google suite of iOS apps. You know, could I put a Google credential somewhere on the device and then have the Gmail app, the Google Drive app, the Google Plus app all talk to that credential? I don't know if that's what that means or not, but not much of an expert on single sign-on, I'm afraid.
Yeah, me neither. As you can
I'm
see.
An expert on many, many different sign-ons at the moment, but not just one yet.
Yeah, so that was a great article. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. That's it's all great.
There's
news.
A couple of other MDM things to mention just quickly, Bradley. We kind of skipped over them because they're up towards the top of the page, but there are many more things you can do over MDM in iOS 7 as well. You can manage OpenIn. You can configure some accessibility options. Configure some AirPrint printers, which might be a big deal. Start to tame some of those Bonjour broadcasts across multiple subnets. And also it says restrict changes to accounts, which is actually something that's quite important if you have a one-to-one with the personal Apple ID. What you don't want to do is you don't want kids signing out of their Apple ID and signing in with a friend's Apple ID and downloading stuff to their iPad and then signing out again. So at the moment, you can control that by touching the device and saying disallow changes to accounts, but this is now something you can do over MDM as well.
The open end sounds interesting. I'm trying to think of, like, if you said, all right, let's say your school says we do all of our PDFs in PDF Expert, and so anytime you have a PDF, it needs to go in there. So you could actually say, like, you know, you can't open it in iBooks, you can't open it in the Kindle app, it's got to be in PDF Expert, and that way a teacher would always know where the PDFs are, and the student can't say, I don't know which app it's in. I opened it and I saw it, but I don't know where it's at. And the teacher has to go through every app that might somewhat support PDFs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's also going to be useful in situations where, say you're deploying staff email, for example, and you don't want your staff to be able to open documents in, say, Dropbox. Because your policy says you're only allowed to go to your school-provided Google Drive account. So you could prevent them from opening it in Dropbox, but let them open it in Google Drive. That kind of thing could be part of a security policy if you have that kind of environment. And obviously in business, that's quite an important thing.
Oh yeah, enterprise, that's huge. Yeah. You know, that's especially if you have financial data or healthcare data, be big.
Yeah.
Of course, the last thing, this is, I guess, teachers can remotely unlock iOS devices into a specific app. This is kind of what we talked about with Casper Focus.
Yeah, that's been there before. You know, that's actually not new in iOS 7. That's possible in iOS 6 as well. Not many MDM vendors have done anything with that. Casper is the one that I know of with the Casper Focus product, which basically just layers a teacher-friendly UI on top of MDM's signals, basically. So the teacher can signal to the MDM server to push certain configurations to certain devices and then pull them off again later on. There's also some new MDM enrollment options, which are quite nice. It says new devices purchased by a school can be wirelessly enrolled into their MDM system during setup. In addition, new devices can be placed wirelessly in supervised mode, which enables enhanced management options. Now, we've talked about supervised mode before, Briley, and it's always been a thing that you have to bring the device to configurator with a cable and say supervise. But now, if you have this streamlined enrollment system, you can actually supervise those devices without having to actually connect them to a computer. So it sounds like, not this year, but in a couple of years' time, or 3 years' time, when we do another refresh, the job I'm about to do this summer is actually going to be basically hand out shrink-wrapped iPads and let the kids just get on with it. But that's not in the sense of giving away all that control, because I'll still be able to, you know, get them enrolled in MDM, get these apps put into their accounts, all that good stuff. But then I won't actually have to basically touch a device until it's in the hands of a student, which is awesome.
Amen to that.
I might get my summers back.
Well, it's just, again, talking about scalability, you know, it's just not feasible. If you're like a, imagine this, like, you know, Los Angeles, imagine their poor IT department. I mean, that trying to deploy, it's a lot of iPads.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you unbox every one of them, and it's like, this is the way to go. You give them a box, they get on the network, you're off and running.
It would be fun. I don't know quite how I would exactly measure this, probably not very scientifically, but it'd be interesting to kind of look at the ages of iOS, like with each generation, each release of the operating system, like what's the biggest deployment you could reasonably scale to with that kind of control. And I think, you know, when we rolled out iPads in 2010, you know, I don't think I could have scaled my deployment much above 100 with the technologies I had at the time. And then, you know, 2011, 2012, on and on and on. And now, you know, come 2013, 2014, it really seems to me that there's essentially no practical limit to how big you could scale an iOS deployment.
Is there any limit, like the Casper suite, on how many, like, one instance of it could do?
I know that Casper supports clustering. So in that sense, you could certainly throw more and more hardware at it until you got to where you needed to be. Or you may have to kind of devolve management to certain groups or whatever. But, you know, these things are getting pretty scalable. I mean, most MDM systems, like we said before, came from big corporate worlds where, you know, they were doing 50,000 BlackBerries or whatever. So, and MDM is a very lightweight protocol as well. It's not a terribly heavy thing. Because even when you're deploying apps, the apps are actually coming from the store. They're not coming from your MDM server. So it's not like you're pushing out big packages of software the way you might do with, say, an Apple Remote Desktop, where you're actually sending the package from the controlling computer to the client computers. All you're doing with MDM is you're sending commands to, say, install this app from the App Store, and the actual data transfer comes from the store, not from your MDM server itself. Could we do a billion devices? I don't know. But we could certainly do... It seems to me absolutely possible, for example, that we could do the whole of Scotland with 680,000-something students. You know? No reason why that couldn't happen.
No, absolutely not. I mean, again...
When you look at Los Angeles, for example, they're almost to a similar scale. You know, LAUSD. You know, it's not so much bigger or smaller. I don't know what the exact number is, but, you know, there are school districts in the US where, instead of the 32... authorities that we have in Scotland running it, there's one for about the same number of students. that's beyond my pay grade. Be a fun challenge, though. It would be a fun challenge.
Well, yeah, it would be. Like, if you, it's almost like if we could do some sort of reality show, and like we put a couple guys on a team. It's like, all right, you got to. It's maybe it's like. Did you ever see this show, like The Apprentice with Donald Trump?
Yeah, and well, we had a different person.
Oh yeah,
yeah. But yeah, I've not have.
So we could do like a tech apprentice, like where, you know, I don't know. Tim Cook could say, "All right, guys, we've got a million customers. Design us an iOS deployment, and the best one wins." I don't, you know, something like that.
Mm. That would be fun. We should pitch that to a TV show, TV network. So that is the new features of iOS 7 for education. We've been specifically talking about the education page. There is another one about business as well, but it's more kind of enterprisey than we're particularly interested in here. But it's just interesting to see sort of more details coming out about iOS 7 that are not under non-disclosure, so we can talk about them. The exact details, I look forward to seeing what they have to show, but we'll keep in touch as those details come out.
Absolutely, yeah. It's I just wish it was out before school started.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm kind of in a bit of a quandary right now because obviously I'm designing our deployment for next year with more and more knowledge that there is a whole different world coming along quite soon. And the challenge for me is to design something this year that doesn't tie me in for, you know, 6 or 7 years from now supporting whatever I do this year. So let's say, for example, I bought a whole bunch of codes and just gave them away to kids from primary 7 to S6, the upper half of the school. That's 7 year groups. And if I've piled a whole lot of money into apps for those guys and they've got them all in their accounts and I can't get them back, and then I want to move to App Store license management, am I going to have to buy those apps again and then, you know, do something for them with App Store licenses and just ignore the ones that I bought this year? Because I'm pretty sure our treasurer is not going to be delighted if I come back to her next year and go, see that £5,000 that we spent last year? Well, we need to spend it again for App Store licenses this year. So if I was to do that and there's no migration path from what I do to App Store license management, then, I mean, it's okay, I can start to use license management for new year groups coming up, but for the 6 or 7 years that I've deployed in a personal model for right now, I'm going to have to support that for years and years to come. So to be honest, I don't know what the answer to that is just yet.
I think I've got it. Just stick with your iPad 1s another year. Problem
solved. I would have mutiny on my hands if I did
that. Just buy some of those Samsung Android cameras and give those to your teachers. Like, problem solved.
Nothing could go wrong. Actually, I hear there's quite a lot of Surface RTs available.
Yes. I would imagine so. I would imagine so.
Yeah. I think there's actually a pallet just sitting on the corner outside my house here for MDO. It's like the Yellow Pages.
Well,
there's Surface tablets coming through my door every day.
Hopefully we'll see maybe some migration options from Apple. And we still have, this info just is fresh this week as we're recording on the 27th. So hopefully we got this information out of the NDA sooner than I thought. And so maybe we'll learn more as we go quickly towards iOS 7.
It's definitely coming. We'll... I think that it's hard to imagine there will not be some kind of migration path. Obviously, nothing's been announced. I don't know what's going on, but, you know, there's a lot of people who have put a lot of money into volume purchase codes because for the past few years, Apple said volume purchase codes are the way to go. And now Apple says App Store licenses are the way to go. So there has to be some kind of way to get from here to there. I think if this is really the future of iOS deployment, and it certainly looks like it is, there's going to have to be something bridging that gap or bridging those two worlds. I just hope that I don't choose the wrong option.
The blue pill or the red pill.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. That's new things from Apple on iOS 7. I don't think this is anything that's not public knowledge, but there's now a beta version for iPad as well. So that's something that I'm going to be taking a look at over the summer.
I installed it. I couldn't resist. On the iPad, not on the phone. I'm refusing to put it on my carry phone. So it's on the iPad.
You know, it's funny. I went shopping with my wife on Saturday. It was her birthday, so I took her shopping. And then we were in the Apple store, of course. How did we manage there on my wife's shopping trip? I don't know, but it happened. And I was looking at an iPod Touch because at that time iOS was only out for phones and iPod Touches. And I was like, oh, it's £250. Should I just buy that and put iOS 7 on it? Or should I wait and see if the iPad one comes out soon? And in fact, the iPad one came out 2 days later. So I resisted the temptation and I now have it up and running on an iPad. So lots of testing work to be done and look forward to doing that.
Yeah, well, and it's so different. I mean, I couldn't figure out how to do like a basic feature of it. I was like, I have to figure this out. Like, I have to Google it. Like, it's I'm glad I'm spending some time with it. But until it's a little bit further along, it's going to stay off of my carry phone.
Yeah, I think it's very much something that you're going to want to have on a device and test. And I think most people who do our kind of job and deploy a number of iOS devices are going to want to test and be aware of what's coming, because, you know, if you have a personal model and your students have control of the device, they are going to be able to press a button and put iOS 7 on their device the first day it comes out. So at the moment, there's nothing you can do to hold it back. It's coming, and your users will put it on as and when suits them. So be ready.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll have lots of internal training sessions.
Yep, for sure. All right. So, shall we wrap it up?
I think so. I guess it's time to go home. I guess my day is done.
Okay. We have done our work for the day. So, let's catch up again next week, Bradley.
Sounds good.
And we shall talk to everybody then.
Adios.
Okie dokie.